This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. First this morning, we're going to be talking to Leslie Keene, New York Times reporter, who first reported on the Navy Department's release of UFO footage, or the Defense Department release of UFO footage, that really changed the world and changed the whole perception of what UFOs are, and left us in the public with no doubt that they are real and they are a mystery. It was one of history's most important stories, and I'm very proud to have Leslie with us today to talk about Project Blue Book, which has jumped into the news again because of a very successful fictional show about Project Blue Book that's running on the History Channel. Leslie, welcome to Dreamland.
Great to be with you, Whitley. Just a comment, too, about that first story that you mentioned. I think a lot of the impact of that, it was the videos that you mentioned, but also just the fact that we were able to reveal that there actually existed a secret government program in the Pentagon that had been studying UFOs for 10 years. I mean, that was really the bombshell part of it, that program even existed at all.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's just the tip of the iceberg. I know I'm sure you and Ralph Blumenthal, who works with you on these stories, are probably digging as deep as you can to find more information about that.
We're always trying to dig as best we can. You're right. And we come up against a lot of walls in the process.
Why is it so secret, do you think, Leslie?
You mean that program in particular?
The whole thing. I mean, you know, you and I both know. We know that there are extensive programs behind closed doors that involve the UFO / alien abduction phenomenon. And I just can't, what I can't figure out is why it is so secret.
I mean, you know, in my explorations with people associated with, particularly with the Pentagon program, which didn't have anything to do with the whole realm of abductions and all of that, but these military cases that they were studying, their goal was to try to understand the technology behind the objects and just how the objects work. And they don't want our adversaries to get that information before they do. I think it's that simple. In terms of the Pentagon, I mean, there's a lot of other people, as you mentioned, that are involved with studying this. But that program in particular wanted to understand what was going on and how these objects do what they do. And if we could replicate that, we would have a huge advantage, and we don't want the Russians or the Chinese or others who are also studying the phenomenon to get access to what we know. It's sort of like there's a race, you know, to get the information, and everybody's trying to keep it to themselves. And I think that's the reason, and it makes sense to me from a Pentagon or a that perspective that the Defense Department holds, which is to protect the American public at all costs, that any kind of exotic technology that they can decipher and put to use, they're not going to want to share it with our adversaries. I think it's that simple.
Probably so. And unfortunately, I know the visitors fairly well at this point in my life after having had them in my life for 30 years. And basically what's going to happen, as long as we take this stance and all three major players do, is nothing, because they ain't doing a thing unless we come clean. This has to belong to every man. It can't be hidden behind closed doors. There will be no progress behind closed doors.
I agree
for certain.
Yep, and that's why I'm trying to get the word out as best I can.
And you're in a really remarkable place to do it, because you're working for the New York Times.
And that's the, I mean, in my opinion, that's the best place. And I feel, you know, I'm just
I think
thrilled
it is.
I think they're getting more and more receptive. Unfortunately, I mean, the things that we were allowed to say in the story that we just published, which came out in the hard edition, hard copy today, actually, you know, yeah, we talk a little bit about the program on the History Channel because that was sort of our way in, but it allowed us to write some pretty profound things about the phenomenon itself that were stated by high-level people back in the 50s and 60s. And the Times was happy with the whole story. There was no pushback or no concern about anything that we said.
Because it's extraordinary what you did say. Can you know? Tell us, just give us a couple of ideas. And folks, by the way, you can go to the Dreamland show page, assuming the site is working, which the site has been under a lot of attack lately, in as most of my listeners know. But you can go to the Dreamland show page if it's up, and click through to the Times story, or just Google New York Times Blue Book, and you'll get right to the story. And if you're listening to this on unknowncountry.com, I'm so glad. But otherwise, it'll be available on YouTube, because the site's been pulled down quite a bit lately. But anyway, go ahead, Leslie. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, they also gave it a very big, you know, in the print edition, it's more than half the front page of the art section. They gave it a really big presentation.
I'm looking at it right now, by the way.
I posted hard photos of it on my Facebook page too, of the hard copy edition.
It's really beautiful.
It's fantastic.
It is the newspaper of record. I mean, people trash it for political reasons all the time, but it is undoubtedly one of the most reliable newspapers in the world. And so getting stories in there, especially stories like this that don't have any political coloring, you know, it's the real deal.
Yeah, I just feel like it's fantastic, and I hope we can just keep doing it. And I think every time a story like this comes out, it really helps move us along. So I'm pleased with that it's all happening. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us some of the high points, some of the moments that struck you. You must have just recently been researching Blue Book to a degree.
Well, actually, not really, because I researched it when I wrote my book in 2010.
Right.
And, you know, I have not really been focused on, you know, UFOs as much, because I have this other topic that I'm involved with. So, you know, I went back to my notes and back to a lot of stuff that I had written during that time, and kind of pulled out what seemed to be some of the most important quotes and most important information. And, of course, I mean, ideally, we would have liked to have had twice the space we had. It's always difficult because you have to fit into a space. And so we had to trim down the story a lot. The upside of that is that you're forced to pick the really, really, really most important stuff. And so, you know, for instance, quoting from some of the memos that were written at the time, you know, by the highest level, one of them being Assistant Director of Scientific Intelligence for the CIA, sent a memo to the CIA director at the time. And he wrote, "Sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes and traveling at high speeds in the vicinity of major U.S. defense installations are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles." So, you know, just a quote like that is like, whoa, for people who think that,
I mean,
UFOs
sort of
are a joke, you know, and like somebody, this is like CIA people writing this. And then we also were able to write about the Robertson panel, which sort of explains, I'm sure your listeners probably know what that is, talks about how the CIA put this policy in place to ridicule UFOs. And it kind of explains the origin of why there's so much ridicule now. And, you know, it helps people maybe shift gears a little bit when they realize, oh, the CIA did this? You mean it's not, they're not really ridiculous? You know, the CIA put this in place as a way of managing all the people's interest in it at the time. And we have a legacy from that still exists. So to be able to say things like that, I think it's just very educational for people. And this is not the kind of stuff that's going into the show, unfortunately, and I've watched 6 episodes of it, and it becomes a sort of thriller more about people than about the phenomenon. And it just kind of gets sillier and sillier as it goes on. So we wanted people to kind of get a sense of how serious the authorities took this at the time. And that the fact that Blue Book was really just a public face of sort of a front and a PR operation for the Air Force, and somewhere that they could tell people to take their reports to sort of calm everything down, but that their real intention was to try to debunk as many as they could and just keep the whole thing under control. That's the key point. I'm sure you would agree. I know you've studied this a lot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've studied it extensively, and I'm inside it in the sense that I have often have contact in various ways with the visitors. And
right.
So, you know, which is quite real. It's not It's not imaginary at all.
I totally get that, Whitley. I've never thought it was imaginary. I mean, I think the other really important thing that we were able to bring into this story is the Bolander memo, which I'm sure you're familiar with. The Air Force.
Yeah, but tell us about it.
Yeah, then when they closed Project Blue Book, the Air Force told the public that there was no UFO that was of any national security concern. And they said some other things too, but let's just talk about that point at first. And we were actually able to write in our story that the Air Force lied. I mean, we were able to use that language, and it's true, because the Bolander memo, which was written a couple of months before they told this to the public, was a secret memo at high levels explaining to different intelligence agencies that they could continue to report UFO cases that were not part of the Blue Book system. And they actually say reports of UFOs which could affect national security would continue to be handled through the standard Air Force procedures. So in that memo, they said more than once that, in fact, UFOs are a national security concern, while telling the public that they weren't. It's a black and white proof of a lie. I think that memo is so important, and I was so happy that we were able to get that into the story.
Which is amazing, because there was a time I heard years ago that Richard Helms had gone to the New York Times in the early 70s and asked them to stop publishing stories about UFOs, which they used to do fairly frequently early on. But now that seems to have changed, because my mind was boggled by your story for that and other reasons. You really have nailed it with this story in the newspaper of record.
I'm glad you feel that way, Willie, because, there's so much more we could have said, but we just tried to. I think that the things that we did bring forward are all just very, very important in terms of establishing the case of the reality of UFOs, as you just said. And it is in the arts section. A lot of it, though, the story really is more like news, but it is in the arts section. So, I hope that people will read it with the understanding that it's really more than an article about this TV show. That was just sort of the hook.
But at least it was there as a hook.
It's here, and it's online. And in the online edition, I included two really lovely videos that I hope people will watch, one of them being the famous press conference by Samford.
Tell us a little bit about that. He has about the least appealing press presence I've ever seen.
I know.
Go ahead.
He has no charisma at all.
None.
But he also looks in the video. You can tell he's very serious, and he's trying not to show a lot of expression. It happened right after the these famous sightings in 1952 of multiple UFOs over Washington D.C. and caught on radar, and many pilots involved, and it was such a big deal that they had to call a press conference about it. And in fact, it was the biggest press conference that had been called since the end of World War II. And because he had to address what was going on. And I'm trying to find the quote. I'm looking at the article in front of me, here it is. So he did this huge press conference, and we posted a video of about 5 minutes, which he said, which is all it really took for him to make his statement. But among other things, he made the famous line that probably a lot of people are familiar with, that a certain percentage of sightings have been made by credible observers of relatively incredible things.
Yes.
And it is this group of observations that we are now attempting to resolve. And so you can actually see him saying that if you go into the story online and look at the video, which I think is awesome.
And it's very striking. We are attempting to resolve. That was in 1952.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Now it is 2018, and guess what? We are still attempting to resolve.
Exactly, and we were able to end our story by making that very point.
Right.
And that's also in our discovery of the program at the Pentagon. We can see that, they might understand the objects a little bit better. They might have a little more scientists, putting their noses to the grindstone in terms of trying to create understanding of how they operate, and we have more data because a lot of time has passed, but nonetheless, we have not resolved the basic problem. And so we really haven't made that much more progress. And we're also still keeping it secret, just like we were then. So it's not much has changed.
Yeah,
and in fact,
I don't think
they had this Project Blue Book, even though it didn't lead to much, but at least there was some place where people could send a report. So we don't even have that anymore.
I don't think that it's ever going to lead anywhere as long as it's kept secret. I think that the visitors will simply not let that door open. Our door to understanding open when the door to the public access is closed. They will not let this become something secret that's only known secretly.
By opening that public door, would that in your sense of things, would that have to involve an actual acknowledgement? Or could it just be that a larger percentage of the population gets that it's real and then we're there? Are you talking about official acknowledgement?
I think that the government has to stop hiding these things. And, you know, and in fact, I know in truth, the United States government has much more knowledge of this than any of the others. Maybe they don't realize that, and they certainly don't know why. Or why it is that the abductions were so concentrated in this country. But there are reasons. And, they just have to come clean. It's as simple as that. There are thousands of documents, thousands of videos, of images. That all has to come out. If it doesn't come out, we will not make any progress.
Well, it certainly hasn't come out yet. And we just move in tiny little increments, you know, like we're doing in our reporting, but nowhere near what you're talking about.
No, but we're running out of time here on planet Earth.
Okay.
So they need.
The thing. We need to get this going fast, especially if you want to get any help from whoever, whatever these UFOs are.
We will receive no help unless this is done, and it has to be done, or there will be no help. Listen, Leslie, it's a great story and a tremendous achievement. All of the work you're doing has always been top drawer, and your work on the New York Times has been history changing, and it is a really important service. And from my own heart, I want to thank you and Ralph for what you do. And folks, this is a wonderful story in the Times. Do not miss it. Read it. Click-throughs help. They notice that. So click on that link and let the Times know you care.
Thanks very much, Whitley. Yeah, the more clicks we get, the better, because the more clicks the Times gets, the more they're going to be open to having other stories like this. So it's very important for people to circulate it and get people to click on that link. That's what matters.
Thank you very much for being with us on Dreamland today, Leslie. Next up, folks, fasten your seatbelts, as you often have to do on this show, because Joseph Farrell is coming back for his 25th visit to Dreamland, and it's a doozy. This is Joseph Farrell's 25th visit to Dreamland since 2006. And why do we keep having him back? Well, two reasons. First, he's got a lot to say. And second, when he does say it, you guys like it. And your listenership jumps way up. And we're always interested in that. Joseph Farrell, welcome back to Dreamland.
Thank you, Whitley. Thank you for having me back.
Well, absolutely. We just had Catherine Austin Fitz on a couple of weeks ago, and that was a very popular show also, as it always is. So I'm glad to have you. I know you and Catherine are quite tight. We can find your work on Catherine's website and, of course, on your own website, GizaDeathStar.com. So, we talked briefly about last year. Right at the end of the year of 2016, actually, you came on the air, and at that point in time, the Patriarch of Russia, the Secretary of State of the United States, and the and Buzz Aldrin had all gone down to Antarctica, for some unknown reason. Maybe they were just decided all to take tours of Antarctica at the same time. Yeah, but I agree. It does sound fairly absurd. Now, as I pointed out then, when I was in New Zealand some years ago, back in the early 90s, in Auckland, people were going absolutely crazy because the United States Air Force was running round-the-clock flights from the airport in Auckland to Antarctica, and they were all secret. No one could approach them. No one knew why. But there is a massive military operation going on down there, and there has been so much strange stuff about Antarctica. Why don't you tell us a little bit about anything you may have picked up recently?
Well, recently there have been, I just saw a couple of stories, one over the last week. Apparently there have been a couple of deaths that occurred with some Americans down there that are connected to Lockheed Martin's presence there. I don't know if a lot of people know, but Lockheed Martin has a presence in Antarctica, which really makes me wonder. You know, when Buzz Aldrin went down there, Whitley, he tweeted out, he was flying, I believe, from South Africa someplace, and he tweeted out getting ready to go to the launch pad. And, you know, there's two ways you can take that. He was just using astronautese for I'm getting ready to board the plane that's going to take me to Antarctica. Or you can take it as Antarctica itself somehow being the launch pad. You know?
Yeah, well, he could, exactly.
Yeah, and Lockheed Martin's presence there, you know, raises the ante considerably that a major defense contractor is not going to have a presence there unless there's something military going on. Then just today, it's interesting that you start out with Antarctica because I just received a story today that China is scouting out, apparently, some places for a heavy lift airbase in Antarctica. And again, you know, that signals something is going on there of some sort of military nature. And on top of all of this, over the last, I think, 2 to 3 months, if I'm not mistaken, there have been a number of independent researchers using Google Maps to spot all sorts of stuff in Antarctica that's just very, very strange. And apparently they're finding ruins, or they are building structures on that continent. One of the two. There's just no two ways about it. So something is definitely going on down there, and everybody's keeping a very tight lid on it. And this is what is kind of amazing. I get the feeling, Whitley, that there's some sort of international agreement among all the people that have outposts in Antarctica, China, the United States, Russia, Australia, and so on and so forth, that they're going to agree to keep everything quiet. So in other words, they found something down there is the way I think of what's going on. They found something down there. And it's either something that is earth-shattering in terms of human history or narrative or whatever you want to call it, or it could be something of technological nature. It could be both. My money would be on both. They're keeping something secret, and there's a reason for all this heavy lift activity. It looks to me like they might be going down there and getting some of this stuff and flying it out. So that's my best guess, but it's certainly high strangeness.
Well, it's very high strangeness, and of course the unspoken question is whether or not something from off-planet is involved, and
yep.
That we can't know. And, you know, I feel increasingly as the years pass that there's a lot more going on than we are allowed to know, that there's something in Richard Dolan's idea of there being a breakaway civilization,
yeah.
But I think it parts of it are right here in plain sight, and we just don't know it because we basically don't know what these people do in their lives and whether or not they have the ability to come and go on the planet is another question. There's persistent things about Mars, and we've published on Unknown Country some very strange imagery from Mars that can't be explained.
Right.
And folks, we'll publish that again. I'll add that to this, to a link to that to this show, and you'll see there are things on Mars that can't be explained, period. And that are never addressed either.
Right.
So it could be that we are kind of the left behind, that there's someone else with many more prerogatives and perhaps even direct contact with aliens and even engaged with them, working with them, while the rest of us sit here on a dying planet in increasingly difficult circumstances. I don't like that very much, naturally.
Well, I don't either, and I think there may be something to your idea that whatever it is going on down in Antarctica may have something to do with an off-planet presence or an off-planet technology. And the reason why I'm willing to entertain that speculation is that when Secretary of State Kerry went down to Antarctica, this was in the middle of one of the most hotly contested elections in American history. It's still being contested.
Yeah,
if you want to look at it.
Donald Trump is about to get sworn in.
Yeah, and he did this right in the middle of a diplomatic junket that he was taking around the world right at the time. So I have to wonder, is his presence in Antarctica because he's conducting some sort of diplomacy? And then the question becomes, well, with who? You certainly don't need to fly down there to, talk to the Chinese or the Russians or anybody else that's down there.
Explaining to someone what's going to happen next, for example, who does not know very much about how things work here.
Right. That could very well be. Unless he wants to conduct really secret diplomacy with some of those countries down there. But again, there are other ways to do that. So his presence there is very mysterious. The same with the Patriarch of Moscow. You don't need a patriarch to go down and bless an Orthodox chapel.
No, and the fact that they were all there at the same time is very odd.
Yeah, it's very, very odd, Whitley. And these recent stories of these deaths and China wanting to build a heavy lift air base on the continent there, this just kind of solidifies it for me that we are not being told the whole narrative. We're being kept deliberately in the dark for whatever reason.
And it's slowly driving the public crazy.
Yep.
The fact that we have been kept in the dark basically since the inception of secret intelligence in the United States in 1945 to 47. The public has been out of the loop, and we are living on a dadgum different planet than the people who are in the loop. Free Dreamlanders, I'm steamed up now, and I'm going to still be steamed up when we get back. Enjoy these commercials and take advantage of the offers.
They are found deep in a dying jungle, 6 infants. They aren't apes. They aren't human either, not quite. So what are they? When they are spirited off to the United States, an incredible discovery is made. They are as smart as us, but not us, not human. The company that found them wants to buy and sell them as the most valuable animals on Earth, brilliant workers who need not be paid. Somebody has to stop this travesty, and that's where primatologist Beth Cook comes in. But can she stand up to the power and wealth that seeks to exploit them? Find out in Whitley Strieber's first standalone science fiction novel in 7 years. New. Get it on Amazon as an ebook or paperback. Whitley Strieber, one of the great authors of our time. War Day changed the way we think about nuclear war. Communion led millions to realize that they had encountered the visitors. Superstorm gave a word to the world that has become the byword of our time. The Key is among the most prophetic books ever written. And where can you get inside the mind that created all this? On unknowncountry.com, where Whitley's life stories, his powerful meditations, his books, Communion, Transformation, The Secret School, and others are available in audio format, and so much more exclusive Whitley Strieber material. Join Whitley on the path to tomorrow.
So we sit here like this, and we could be accessing a much more extraordinary world. Now, I want to slightly shift gears to something that extraordinary world might be doing to us. When I was talking to Catherine, mm-hmm. one of the subjects that came up, I think that you are very well aware of, is some of the strange things that associated with the California fires.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm wondering if we can't discuss that a little bit, because it was a deeply personal experience for me. I was not burned out, but I have close friends whose homes were destroyed in these fires. And I can certainly see a natural element in the cause of the fires.
Yes.
But was something else also present, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, I do. I mean, on the natural side, it is true that as far as I'm aware, that the wilderness areas in California have not been taken care of adequately to prevent some of these things. There's a lot of undergrowth and brush and shrubbery and dry leaves and so on and so forth. But leaving all of that aside, Whitley, the pictures that I have seen, and these are, as you are probably well aware, are making their way around the internet at lightning speed. There are just too many pictures of homes just totally burnt to the ground, of cars with their rims melted literally in place. And right next to these homes, just as we saw in the fires last year, the brush, the shrubbery, the trees are untouched. They're not burnt at all. So the question becomes, how do you burn down homes and buildings and leave a lot of the shrubbery and vegetation unburned? This is the mystification to me. And then add to this some of the reports that I have heard. I don't know if you've heard these as well, but I've heard reports from some people that the fire and the way it started, that there are people literally missing from their homes, and they're presumed dead, of course, but...
Yeah, in the Paradise Fire there are. That's not true in Santa Monica. I mean, in Malibu, everybody has been accounted for, but there are people in the Paradise Fire who are not on the list of dead, because nobody knows anything about them. They're simply gone.
Yeah, they're just simply gone. And I have to wonder, you know, there's been a variety of explanations, Whitley, as to what is causing these things. And I've heard everything. I've seen videos. I've seen pictures that people that live out there that are members of my website have sent me of fires apparently having broken out at the electrical meters. So some people are thinking smart meters may have been responsible. Other people are thinking in terms of some sort of exotic or directed energy weaponry and so on and so forth. And I'm not willing to dismiss any of them. Just today I was reviewing some videos that someone had sent me of the shockwaves from some of these fires, and they're just bizarre. And the smart meter thing really got me thinking. I even blogged about this after I saw some of these pictures. I even posted them on my website. What really got me about these things is that most people are unaware that the electrical circuitry in your home can act as a broadcast antenna. In other words, you can send signals through the power grid itself and activate things just like you would, you know, send a radio wave through the air. You can send it through the wires and activate some of these devices that may have been put in homes in the form of smart meters or whatever, and just literally start them on fire and burn them to the ground. You know, that's one theory that's out there. So there's a lot of anomalies about these fires that make me think that these, pardon me, cannot be entirely natural or explained with entirely natural causes. So then the question becomes, well, why? What's going on here? And I really don't know, other than to say I think, pardon me, that Catherine Fitz may be onto something, that they are in a hurry to buy up a lot of land in California, prime land and real estate in Northern California, and do this in order to reshore and retrench a lot of expertise and expand the Silicon Valley, you know, northward of the Bay and so on and so forth, to bring in a lot of expertise. That's one possibility. There's just too much about this that leaves one scratching one's head. And to top, you know, to put kind of the cherry on top of all of this Sunday that I'm dishing out here, the PG&E aspect of this story is also very interesting, because I did a little digging and discovered that they were connected to some sort of company doing weather satellite, weather modification satellites and things of this nature. So something weird is going on there. And it may be that California, as it has functioned in the past, is the test bed for, you know, something that they intend to apply at a wider regional basis, just outside of the state altogether. So I don't know, but the fires are just too dang anomalous.
Well, you know, one of the advantages of having a big, well organized website like Unknown Country is that we have a deep memory.
Right.
This is a story from February the 12th, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Fires have broken out in part of a Sicilian village, and no one can figure out what's causing them.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be electricity, since the power has been cut off. Despite this, note that despite this, washing machines, dishwashers, refrigerators, electricity meters, and cables have been spontaneously bursting into flames.
Right.
Now, fast forward a few years to 2008, another story, the Italian government announcing that they have studied this situation extensively and do not know what happened.
Right.
Here's a witness. Donatello and Giancarlo Zuin stood talking and noticed the parked car they had arrived in burst into flames. "We watched the rear plastic light slowly melt in front of our eyes," said Zuin. "There was more and more smoke, and then it burst into flames. I could not believe it." And it's one story like that after another. And if you look at the witness reports from Paradise, it's the same kind of stories. Same stories.
Yep.
So when people say, "Oh, it's just conspiracy theory," I'm sorry.
No,
there's something else afoot. This isn't. That's not the only thing. Yes, the winds, the possible defective power supply, power stations, et cetera, and so forth, are all certainly implicated. But it's as if this other thing was folded into it.
Yes.
To
yes.
hide it within the natural fire.
Yes, absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with that, Whitley, and I'll tell you another reason why. Because if we go back and look at the fires in Greece that occurred shortly after the previous year's fires in California, many of the same features are found in those fires as well. Buildings burning, cars and vehicles burning, and nearby shrubbery not burning. So I'm, you know, I go back to a phenomenon that Dr. Judy Wood talked about in her book about 9/11 and the Trade Center towers collapse, the two tall towers. She talks a great deal in the book about her toasted cars phenomenon, all these cars that were found around in and around Manhattan, far away in some cases from ground zero, that either had their engine blocks melted or, as we saw in the Paradise fires recently in California, the metal rims on the wheels melted and so on and so forth. I think, Whitley, what you're looking at is some sort of resonance effect of some sort of exotic energy that's being poured into these places and catching things on fire through resonance. Through the phenomenon, you know, that would be in addition to the smart meters theory that some people have been advocating out there. And it would explain, in terms of the Paradise Valley, people that have gone simply missing, that aren't accounted for. Well, if they're inside these cars when they catch fire or begin to experience some of these effects, you know, the sky's the limit there. What happened to them? Did they burn up? Did they disintegrate? You know, what?
Yeah, exactly. What happened to them?
Yeah, what
it's almost as if they're an outbreak of cases of spontaneous combustion.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, it's exactly. Very, very creepy. Well, speaking of creepy, Free Dreamlanders, here are some announcements that will undoubtedly creep you out. We'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber has published an incredible 2-volume historical novel called In Hitler's House under his open pseudonym Jonathan Lane. This amazing story follows the life of William Weber, who meets Hitler while touring Germany in 1931 and becomes his friend and confidant. But then, when he realizes the truth, becomes a spy in Hitler's house for the Allies. Living a life of terrible danger, he falls in love with another of Hitler's secret friends, also a spy in his house. This is a story of espionage and desperate love, and the deepest portrait of Adolf Hitler ever created. Don't miss In Hitler's House, available in paperback and as an ebook on Amazon.
You've probably heard the music for years. It's the theme song for Dreamland. But you may not know the name of the piece, The O of Pleasure. Or the name of the composer, Ray Lynch. Ray Lynch is a 3-time Billboard Award winner. Ray is also the composer of the platinum album, Deep Breakfast. Pandora calls Ray one of the most influential artists in New Age pop and adult alternative circles. For music that will move your heart and set your spirit soaring, visit www.raylynch.com.
This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Joseph Farrell. His website, GizaDeathStar.com. Go to Giza Death Star. There is an absolutely amazing amount of information there. You know, we're considered people kind of at the edge, fringy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you look, folks, at something like Giza Death Star, this website, how long have you been doing this, Joseph?
We started it in, I think, about 2008, 2009. So it's been almost a full decade.
Yeah. So I'm talking to a guy whose website's been there working for 10 years. Mine's been working for 20 years. And this is solid stuff. This is and we have been looking at these strange things all of this time. We have in-depth memory now. Like, you know, I'm talking about similar events that happened in Sicily in 2004. No one anywhere else in the news is even close to remembering that kind of stuff. They're all here for this current 20-minute, 15-minute news segment, and that's it. There's much more going on. I just want to mention in passing something we briefly discussed, Catherine Austin Fitz and I briefly discussed, which is Jack Kasher's report on mission STS-48, shuttle mission STS-48, where you see coming up from below, which we've determined was from Pine Gap, or from Central Australia, I should say, a pulse of energy that causes a number of little white dots to dart off into it at breakneck speed.
Yep.
And this is a pulsed energy weapon being fired at the little white dots. And what do you suppose they may be? They're not astronauts. They're not meteors. They're UFOs. And they're being fired at. Therefore, that is real. And so is that weapon. Now, one of the first things you're going to want to do with a weapon like that is to point it down, because it gives you so much control over what's going on below.
Yep.
Now, you know, we'll see with time whether or not the areas of the burn areas that were all that railroad was supposed to go through end up enabling the railroad to be finished, because right now it doesn't look like it's going to be finished because it's too expensive. So the high speed rail system. I don't know if you've looked at the maps, but a lot of people have these maps out there that show that the high speed rail system went right through the areas that are the burn areas.
Yes.
Very convenient because, of course, it vastly decreased the value of those burn areas.
Yep.
Okay. Yep. So now I want to move on. We're sort of doing a little digest show here. And this is these odd seismic waves that have been pulsating around the planet. Something's way off here, Joseph, obviously. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what your thinking is?
Well, I first encountered these, Whitley, back when I wrote Roswell and the Reich, and I even put a picture of some of these waves at the end of that book, because there was a German kind of amateur seismologist that was picking up all of these very, very large, in terms of amplitude, large waves coming out of Antarctica. And he even put up on his site, you can look in the book, because I put the pictures of these waves. They're just bizarre, Whitley. They are all over the seismogram. And they're enormous. They're enormous waveforms. And he put up on his site a seismic wave of a nuclear explosion, which, of course, was just dwarfed by these things. And now we've got this story of the seismic waves that are appearing that people have noticed and been posting. So something is going on inside the planet. And, you know, I'm thinking of the movie Core, where they discover that the internal dynamo of the planet is slowing down, and as it slows down, the magnetic field, of course, is collapsing, and we've been, you know, hearing about that story for a number of years. So I'm wondering if maybe we're watching something like that happen, or, as that movie also brought out, and it's a fascinating movie, it's kind of a Hollywood B movie, but interestingly enough, it's discovered in there that their experiments with deep, low, extremely low and ultra low frequency waves inside the planet that they've been using to communicate with submarines and so on and so forth actually cause this phenomenon. So in other words, we may be, and this is my other best guess here about what may be going on with these seismic waves, we may be looking at some sort of resonance effect in the planet from all of these exotic technologies that we're told nothing about. And, you know, right at the top of the list, you can put CERN. Because if you investigate the magnetic field strength that is in those magnets, it's enormous in those detectors, in that device. It's several times the local magnetic field strength of the planet. And my thinking is, and you've even got some sites out there, Whitley, that are tracing when the collider has been active and then demonstrating dips in the magnetic field of the northern hemisphere of the Earth. So I have to wonder if by playing around with these ionospheric heaters, with these big particle accelerators like CERN, the Z machine out at Sandia, you know, that they use to study nuclear explosions by creating extraordinarily large electromagnetic pulses in plasmas. I have to wonder if we're looking at unintended resonance effects of some of these things, and if that might be the explanation behind these seismic waves. I think, in other words, part of it is potentially man-made.
In other words, they're monkeying around and not telling us what they're doing, and eventually they break up the planet.
Right. Well, you know, think of Nikola Tesla here, Whitley. Because you've got, with Tesla, of course, when he was building his infamous or famous Wardenclyffe wireless power project in New York, he indicated in the trial that was brought to him to pay some debts to fund that thing, in the trial, he stated that he had to sink all the iron pilings down into the earth because it was necessary to get a grip on the earth. Well, if you study what Tesla was up to, in my opinion, he was simply inverting the normal circuitry of broadcast power. In other words, rather than using the atmosphere as the medium through which you're broadcasting, you're using the planet as the antenna, as the broadcast, and you're using the atmosphere as the ground return circuit. And if that's the case, you know, it puts his subsequent remarks that he makes, I think, to the New York Post or New York Times after the collapse of that project, that, yeah, you know, give me the right resonance and I can crack the planet in half. And again, you know, if he's thinking in these terms in the early 20th century, certainly it's possible that all of this gadgetry that we've built out, you know, CERN, the ionospheric heaters, the other particle accelerators, and so on and so forth, could be having some unintended or possibly even intended effects.
Well, what's always worrisome to me is that I know people who are behind the door of secrecy, and what troubles me always is that they're never as good as people who are out in the public. There is no Stephen Hawking hiding behind the wall of secrecy, because a person of that caliber doesn't want his work hidden. He wants to be part of the scientific community and rise to prominence in that community, with very few
right.
exceptions, which right. means that it could be that things that are far, that require far more intelligent and insightful management than is available behind the barrier of secrecy are happening there, and that worries me.
Yeah, it does me too, and you make an excellent point there, because the only attraction that these projects can have for people of high intelligence can only be for people not only of high intelligence, but absolutely no sort of moral grounding. In other words, you know, I'm going to enter this world because I've got a lot of money and I can make a lot of cool stuff and just see what happens.
And people whose souls are already dead and they know it.
Right, exactly. And then, as you say, the other thing that results from that sort of culture, if you want to put it loosely, is you're going to attract people with lesser management ability. They're not going to be thinking in terms of backlash or spillover effects into other systems that they, you know, that's not on their radar focus. So they're going to be essentially, as you put it, incompetent. And that's every bit a possibility, as far as I can tell. You know, I've met a few of these people in my life as well, and to me, they're just astonishing sometimes for their narrow view of things.
And they're incredible. Arrogance so great they don't even know it is arrogance.
Right, exactly. They don't know it's arrogance.
They don't know it's arrogance. It's, you know, sometimes I think that this planet is in the grip of a kind of disease, and some people in it are part of that disease somehow. Free Dreamlanders, listen up.
Did you know that the Unknown Country newsletter is absolutely free and comes to you by email once a week? The newsletter has been published since 2000, and in all that time, not one subscriber has ever received a single piece of spam, because they were on our list. But what they have received, week in and week out, is the very latest from unknowncountry.com, including a Dreamland preview and all the latest news. Go to unknowncountry.com and sign up today. You owe it to yourself, and it's free. War Day is one of Whitley Strieber's most powerful books. Join him and his co-author Jim Konietka as they travel across the United States devastated by limited nuclear war. This acclaimed novel was originally published in the 1980s, but now that North Korea has said that they can hit the U.S. with nukes, it's more timely than ever. Don't miss this informative, exciting, and convincing testament to the power of the human spirit in challenging times like our own. Get the ebook for $3.99. Go to Strieber.com for this and all of Whitley's great books.
We're talking to Joseph Farrell. His website, GizaDeathStar.com. Giza Death Star has been going a long time, and it is a rich, rich fund of information, just like Unknown Country. You can use the search engines on these websites to learn things that you really will not find elsewhere, simply for two reasons. First, the rest of the world doesn't look as deeply, and it prefers just not to look in certain directions, but we're not like that. Now, I want to get back to Antarctica. I want to circle around at this point. Mm-hmm. You wrote a book a few years back called Hess and the Penguins,
Yep.
The Holocaust, Antarctica, and the Strange Case of Rudolf Hess. And I'm wondering if we can't gain, by discussing some of the topics in this book, a little bit more insight into what in the heck is going on in Antarctica, because this is important, and what we are being told and what we are led to believe cannot be the truth.
Well, yeah, I think we can gain some things, because in a certain sense, Whitley, I've always been of the view that this Antarctic strangeness really begins with that 1938-1939 German expedition to Antarctica, because the sponsorship of that expedition was none other than Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring. And this is not a man that's going to be sponsoring a science project. And the narrative is, the official narrative is, well, the Germans were looking for, you know, whaling and oil and lubricants and so on and so forth, which certainly is a plausible explanation. But the fact that this expedition takes place, and then on its return to Germany, something unusual happens that really sent my suspicion meter into the red zone, so to speak. And that was, number one, Göring telegraphed the leader of the expedition, Captain Ritschl, a message of congratulation that this expedition was going to put Greater Germany and its scientific efforts on the map. And then everything goes absolutely dead quiet. So enter Rudolf Hess. Why does Rudolf Hess enter this picture? Well, because Hess, at this time, is the Stellvertreter, as the German title was, the placeholder, quite literally, for Adolf Hitler as the head of the Nazi Party. So Hess was in an extraordinarily powerful position. He was also a minister without portfolio in the cabinet, and he, in addition to all of this, he was the commissar, and this is something that most people are unaware of. He was the commissar for technological development in the Reich. In other words, he had his fingers in every black project's pie that there was inside of Nazi Germany at that time. Then he flies off to Great Britain in May of 1941, and the rest is history. And what I uncovered, Whitley, as I was searching for this, because I've always maintained that there's some connection between Antarctica and Hess, simply by dint of the fact that he had his hands in so many pies inside the Third Reich. Well, I discovered that while he was in Britain, A British lord, an envoy of Winston Churchill, had contacted Hess when he was in captivity in Britain and asked to see him, and Hess, you know, took the meeting. And during the meeting, this British lord, I forget what his name was, but this British lord asks him about the treaty that Hess has brought to Great Britain to sign and take Britain out of the war so that Germany would not face a two-front war when it invaded the Soviet Union. And the British lord asks Hess, well, do these assurances include Greece, he mentions Greece, and Norway? And the reference to Norway there, I think, is really a kind of coded reference to Antarctica, because when the German expedition had returned to Europe in 1939, the Norwegian government issued a protest to the German government that the lands that the Nazis were claiming in Antarctica were in fact under a prior claim by Norway. And the German Foreign Ministry responded that it did not acknowledge Norway's claims in Antarctica. And the reason why was that Norway had not explored it, had not developed it, nor sought to develop it, and that the German claims went in and were based upon exploration of the continent that went much further inland than Norway. So in other words, the way I'm reading it, Whitley, is that Antarctica was kind of referred to by the British and in this private negotiation with Hess. And Hess's response was very interesting. He said, the Führer has not spoken on this matter. So in other words, I think the game is afoot, the geopolitical game. Whatever's going on in Antarctica now with Kerry and Buzz Aldrin and the Chinese and patriarchs of Moscow and so on and so forth, I'm thinking is a long-term continuation of whatever game was afoot down in Antarctica before, which puts the German expedition and the reason for its the reason that you can hardly find out any information about it these days. I think it could be that some of that information was classified by the Germans after that expedition, and that they may have either photographed something in their flyover missions in that part of Antarctica that they were exploring, or they found something and took it back with them. I don't know, but given what we've said before, I wouldn't rule it out.
Well, it's really fascinating because as I say, we all know that there is something going on there. And the fact that the Chinese are getting involved as well, are the Russians heavily invested down there too? I believe they are.
Yes, absolutely they are. Absolutely. They have extensive facilities there. They've even built a chapel, which is ostensibly why the patriarch went down there. But, a few years prior to all of this, we had those extraordinarily weird goings-on around the Russian presence around Lake Vostok, which is that underground lake in Antarctica. And, for a while, the Russians were talking about it, and then all of a sudden they clammed up. There were rumors that people had become sick all of a sudden, had to be flown out, which, of course, happened to Buzz Aldrin when he was down there.
That's right. It sure did.
Yeah, something's going on, Whitley, and we don't know, but I strongly suspect that this goes back to the German expedition. And there's one more thing we need to remember about this German expedition, and I'm gonna lay a lot of dots out there for everybody, and just you make of them what you will, but the Germans actually brought over Admiral Richard Byrd prior to their expedition to have him brief them on the conditions that they would find there and so on and so forth. Then after the war, of course, we had Admiral Byrd again in the news when he was in charge of Operation High Jump, which was the big American expedition to Antarctica. It included an aircraft carrier, a literal flotilla of naval vessels and quite a few Marines. And the story, Whitley, was that we were going down there because in the next war, the Arctic regions would be, a hot zone. And so we were going down there to test our tactics and equipment. And I'm thinking, this is an absurd explanation because the United States has Alaska, the northern Canada, and the regions up there. If you're going to test equipment in those kind of conditions, you don't need to drag a flotilla halfway around the world to do so. Okay. And the other thing that I pointed out in the Hess book is that the planning for Operation High Jump was at an extraordinarily high level. It included Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz, and here it comes, it included the then Secretary of the Navy, John Forrestal, who, of course, dies under extremely suspicious circumstances. And then add to this something else that most people are not aware of. There was a Colonel Byrd who was a close relative of Admiral Byrd, and he was the owner of the Texas School Book depository in 1968.
Well, now you have actually got me. I wish Jim Mars was still around to hear that. I wonder if he knew that.
He probably did. I don't know, but if you dig into Colonel Byrd, you'll discover that he was Admiral Byrd's one of his close relatives. And then, just to put another kind of cherry on this sundae, Admiral Byrd's son, and I did put this in the Hess book. His son was invited to speak at the National Geographic because Admiral Byrd had written an enormous article for the National Geographic. In fact, it took up most of the issues. It was over 100 pages long about Operation High Jump after his return. And they invited his son to the National Geographic to give a speech on some anniversary of Operation High Jump. And on his way to Washington, D.C., he took the train. He disappeared. And he was discovered he disappeared for several weeks, as a matter of fact, and they discovered him in an abandoned warehouse in Baltimore, Maryland. And the Baltimore police were treating it as a homicide. The witnesses that claimed that they saw Byrd's son claimed that he was in the presence of another individual, and that was the last anybody saw of him. So there again, there's more high strangeness surrounding Antarctica. We don't know what it is, but there's all sorts of dots here that are just too uncanny when you get right down to it. Because again, you know, President Kennedy was a very close friend of Secretary Forrestal. They knew each other, and Kennedy himself had visited Forrestal's grave any number of times. So there is possibly some sort of Antarctic connection lurking in the background of all of that that happened in Dallas in 1963 as well, and we don't know what it is.
Well, you know, what a tangled and wonderfully fascinating web you weave. I just love having you on the show because all of us are, I'm sure, exactly in the same position I'm in right now. Wait, does this tie into that? Does that, this... And where it takes you is it takes you into a realization that we don't know where we are.
Right.
We don't know what's actually happening. We don't even know what we are because right. if we knew, we should, none of this should be secret.
Right.
But it's terribly, deeply secret. And that's why we don't know what we are.
Yeah.
Because something is kept from us and if we understood ourselves, we would know why, and we don't. Well, another area that has been kind of in the back of my mind, largely because of those seismic waves we talked about a bit earlier, mm-hmm. is the story that has sort of faded from consciousness of the possibility that the Earth's crust may not be stable, that it may shift from time to time. Mm-hmm. And if it does shift, this happens during periods when the ice pack is melting and the weight of all of that ice is moving off of the poles and into the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's whatever happens, and we talked about the core of the Earth a little earlier being responsible for those waves, happens so deep that it doesn't change the structure of the surface. In other words, if this was happening frequently in geologic time and it was close to the surface, the planet would be rubble. But it's not. It has right. very ancient geologic features. Now, a couple of things. First, I have recurring dreams of extraordinary inundations. That's number one. Number two, Linda Moulton Howe, when we talked on the show, mentioned when I brought this up that she gets dozens of emails from people with similar dreams. Now, you put those two things together, they may not mean much, but maybe they mean a lot. Another thing is that there is a geodesic line around the Earth that contains on that line all kinds of sacred sites from
yes.
You know about that.
Yes.
And it's 1,520 miles. If you do a horizontal through, a vertical through it, rather, excuse me, it comes out 1,520 miles due west of the physical North Pole.
Yes.
Suggesting that the planet shifted in fairly recent times. What do you make of all this?
Oh, I think that there's definitely something to this idea of a grid. And, you know, I wrote a book called Grid of the Gods, and it does appear to me, Whitley, that these sites, I'll just be blunt, that these sites, particularly some of the strange features of the pyramidal structures in Mesoamerica and incidentally in India, where these things appear to be built as resonators of some sort. In other words, we may be looking at some sort of ancient effort or megalithic effort or what have you to build out a machine on the surface of the planet for whatever reason, to either stabilize or destabilize the crust. And I think there's something to that, because in that book, Grid of the Gods, I pointed out that some of the features of these Mesoamerican and Indian pyramids almost look like they had been deliberately designed by a knowledge of higher dimensional mathematics. And the use of that, in my opinion, could only be for some sort of engineering of the medium, be it local celestial space or the planet itself. So I do think there's something to that. As to what and how they were thinking, I don't know. But it has every appearance of that. And speaking of Antarctica and inundations, the other thing that made aware of in the last 3 months is apparently, and there were pictures of this, I blogged about it on my website, there were pictures of an ice sheet that had broken off from Antarctica. And this was taken by a NASA airplane that supposedly, according to the story, was just happened to be flying over it at the time. Okay. But if you look at this ice sheet, Whitley, it is almost perfectly rectilinear.
Yes, I've seen that. It's really very strange.
It's very, very strange. It's almost like someone had cut this huge chunk of ice off of the ice shelf. It is just very bizarre. And so the question arises, you know, you can't get a rectilinear feature like that naturally, breaking off the ice shelf. It has to be cut. Well, how do you cut something like that? Well, the easiest, the most obvious way would be through some sort of exotic energy technology, quite literally. So something very strange is going on. And the idea that someone would cut off an ice sheet and of that volume and mass, to me, kind of indicates that maybe there's something behind all these people, including yourself, having dreams of vast inundations. Who knows? I don't. But it's all very strange.
Well, it is. And it's troubling to me, because I often have the sense that perhaps there's somebody here mm-hmm. who wants the planet without us, but is
right.
having trouble figuring out how to do that.
Right.
You know, in other words, how do you keep the planet intact and get rid of us?
Yeah.
Am I being too paranoid?
No, you're not being too paranoid at all. I just talked with Richard Dolan last night, and he discussed an interview that he's given with Dr. David Jacobs, and this is kind of the conclusion that Dr. Jacobs has come to, that they are... that there's some effort on the part of them to infiltrate us and this planet. And, you know, I've said this myself at the Secret Space Program conferences. If we take all of those ancient stories of a genetic tinkering with humanity by some sort of genetic cousins way back when, you know, they look like us, they walk like us, and so on and so forth, the only way that you could determine any presence like that on this planet would be through genetics. And lo and behold, what we've seen in the last few years is that there has been this mad scramble to develop technologies that will allow you to sequence someone's genome quite literally in the field without having to send it off to a laboratory and so on and wait a couple days. The FBI has bought into this technology, and then we have all of these examples of road stops in this country where people are being asked to swab their DNA. Well, the question is why? What are they looking for? I don't view this activity as simply being explainable simply on the basis of trying to collect, you know, data for some gigantic genetic database. It could be that, but at the same token, if you're looking for a non-human but humanoid presence on this planet, that would be the way you'd go about it. You'd cloak it in another story, and you'd develop technologies to sequence the genome, quite literally in the field, so that you could spot people, and people that aren't people, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, you know, back in, I guess, about 1995 or 6, and I was in discussions with a gentleman from who was working then for the one of the select Senate Select Intelligence Committees, one of the subcommittees, not subcommittees, but a separate committee. And they were working on this subject. And he told me that the greatest government's greatest fear is that there would be beings with an entirely hidden and non-human agenda who looked just like us, who got into positions of power.
Right.
And I made a joke about this in such a way that it was picked up by a national security agency monitoring system near where I lived, and I had more darn trouble with that. I'm still, I think, suspect, because it was just a joke. But, the thing is, maybe they're not here to harm us. Maybe they are here for some other reason that has nothing to do directly with helping us or harming us, but obtaining something from us that we really don't need, or it could be that they're here to help us. We just don't know what that might be about.
Yeah, we don't know. I suspect, Whitley, that if we go back, and I tried to speak to this point in 2015 at the Secret Space Program Conference in Texas, that if you're the national security state after World War II and you're confronted with three strategic problems, you're confronted, first of all, of course, with the communist bloc. Secondly, you're confronted with what I've been calling this post-war extraterritorial Nazi state. And thirdly, you're confronted with UFOs. So and of the three, of course, the UFO is the big one. So what's your response going to be? Well, I suspect that national security state is not only going to establish hidden systems of finance, which I definitely have argued for in my books, they're also going to go back and they're going to look at all of these stories from ancient times, from the Bible, from Mesopotamia, and so on, about this intervention genetically with humanity. And if they do that, then they're going to immediately think, well, good grief, we could be in the process of being infiltrated and subverted right now. We've got to figure out a way to detect this and find out what they're up to. So, yeah, I would agree with you. The one thing that those texts would have cautioned them about is that in those texts, the agenda of the people doing the genetic engineering isn't too pro-human.
So, right.
That's the other thing they've got to contend with. So, the way I look at it, this whole frenzy after the war to, first of all, crack the genetic code itself and discover the double helix and so on and so forth, there's little aspects of that whole story that are a little bit fuzzy that make me think that something else is going on here. There's that, and then there's this recent development that we've seen in genetics of the CRISPR technology, the ability to edit genomes fairly quickly and easily. We've seen the development of these field application sequencing technologies and so on and so forth. So something, I think, is definitely afoot. And I think, like you, they're probably looking for somebody or something in the genome.
Well, they may be. And, of course, the CRISPR technology offers the promise of things like we think to ourselves, oh, my, maybe we could create a race of super geniuses.
Yeah.
But it goes a lot deeper than that because we might be able to create a race of passive super geniuses who were to essentially be biorobots.
Yeah.
Us under another, us without our independence of spirit.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Absolutely terrifying.
It is, and especially so, you know, you're not just speculating off the top of your head, because if you look at some of the things that DARPA is up to, precisely in terms of engineering super soldiers and so on and so forth, this is exactly what they're after. Exactly what they're after.
Well, exactly. It is precisely what they're after. Joseph, we're coming to the end of our hour together. I want to know what you're working on now, or if you want to say.
Well, I don't really ever give out specifics, but I am researching three different possibilities for books kind of all at the same time. I just came out with a new book a couple months ago called Microcosm and Medium, which is up on my website.
And which folks you can listen to. He's read it himself. It's an audio book on his website.
Yeah, it's an audio book, and it's also an actual published book at Lulu, self-published book at Lulu. But I'm looking into doing either kind of a sequel to that or kind of branching out from it in certain ways. So I'm looking in three different areas right now on doing that and researching a pile of books that's stacked up in my living room.
Which has been the case for a long time.
For a long time.
Joseph Farrell, Giza Death Star, an in-depth journey into a world we almost can see and understand, but not quite, but it's a very important world. What a career, Joseph, and may you continue for many long years to enlighten us further. Good luck and God bless in 2019.
Well, thank you, Whitley, and the same to you, my friend.
How can we even conceive of a year as strange as 2019?
I don't know about you, but I'm looking forward to it with mixed apprehension and feelings. So.
Yeah, same here. Thank you very much, Joseph.
Thank you, Whitley.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.